You welcome to your turn, Mike Causey. Glad to have you with us as we are here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. And we're going to be talking about a variety of things today, using the F word, furloughs, talking about sequestration, your rights during that. And then we'll take a look at what the Postal Service is doing or attempting to do with its health plan, the Federal Employee Health Plan. We'll look at a new initiative to get rid of deadwood in government and, of course, talk about the pending federal pay freeze. So lots on our plate. But my first guest is John Mahoney. John is with a prominent Washington law firm here, and he specializes in federal employee matters. John, you were talking with Tom Timmon and Amy Kopp earlier, I think yesterday, correct?
Yep, sure did. How you doing, Mike?
I'm fine. Yeah, listen, the sequestration is almost upon us, due to kick in March 1st. The Congress is out of town this week. The president has a rather light schedule, so the politicians are all saying it can't happen, it shouldn't happen, but many people say it's inevitable. When it hits, we've started hearing the horror stories. Many people downplayed it. Now, the Defense Department this afternoon is having a briefing for reporters on what the impact on defense. The FAA has talked about it. The Justice Department has talked about furloughing FBI agents. What's your take on this thing?
I think it's going to have a huge negative impact, not only in the federal sector, but in the private sector, especially in the DMV area.
Well, what about a situation? It starts March 1st. If it starts, it will start March 1st. But aren't 30-day furlough notices required of employees?
That's right, yep. If the federal agencies are going to furlough their employees for 30 days or less, they have to give those employees 30 days advanced written notice and give the employees an opportunity to reply, just like a proposed disciplinary action. The employees get to review all the materials upon which the proposed furlough is based, and they can make affirmative defense arguments. If they can find that the agency is furloughing one group over another and not fairly applying it across the board, then the employees can challenge it as being a prohibited personnel practice or disparate impact based on, you know, EEO grounds or whatever. So there's a lot of different ways to potentially challenge this. You know, first and foremost, the unions are going to have the ability to negotiate over the impact and the implementation of the furloughs. So we've got a little bit of a lead time after March 1st before the furloughs will actually start. You know, I'm predicting sometime around the middle or end of April at the earliest.
Well, I would think that legally, the furlough notices can't go out until at least March 1st. Would that be correct?
Yep, that's what I believe.
You know, okay.
It is possible that Congress and the president, even though everybody's on vacation, could come up with a deal to avert this before March 1st. So the notices can't go out until, you know, probably March 2nd. And because, you know, if they're going to be 30 days or less in terms of the furlough length, the employees are entitled to 30 days advance notice. And if the furloughs are going to be more than 30 days, then it's considered to be a RIF, reduction in force, and the reduction in force procedures apply, which require the employee to get 60 days advance notice of the RIF. So, you know, it's going to be challenging because each agency and each part of each agency can decide to apply the RIFs in their own particular way. So it's going to be an administrative nightmare for the federal government, frankly.
So you're looking at April before anybody takes a Friday off or something like that?
I think so. I mean, they've got to give at least 30 days advance notice. So, you know, it'll probably be the middle of April, I would think, before people are actually furloughed.
Well, is there if I wanted to be a difficult employer, if I thought this was just wrong, could I? You said I have a chance to respond. What could I say to the agency that would maybe halt the action?
Well, what I would do if I were representing such an employee is I would request from the agency, after receiving the, you know, the proposed RIF or the proposed furlough notice, all of the materials upon which the agency relied to propose the furlough, including how did you come up with the method by which some employees would be furloughed and others would not. And then I would, you know, take a look at that analysis and take a look at that data to see if there's any argument to be made that the way the agency is rolling out the furloughs is going to have a disparate impact on a particular group of employees, whether it be the union employees are getting furloughed longer than the non-union employees, or whether there are, you know, a discrimination basis based on race, color, sex, national origin, age, disability, religion, prior EO activity, or, you know, prior whistleblower whistleblower or union activity. So if there's a way for you to poke a hole in, you know, the method by which the agency is proposing to furlough employees, and you can show that it's having a disparate impact on a protected group, you could challenge legally the entire furlough.
Could I demand that they give me a copy of the document, the OMB document, which is, by the way, 394 pages? I mean, it seems like that would destroy every tree in Oregon if employees ask for something like that.
They certainly could, and they certainly could also ask for the internal agency documentation, the memorandums between the upper-level management officials in terms of how the furlough is going to be rolled out in that particular agency. So the employees can ask for a lot of different types of documentation to make their argument. And then they have the right to reply to the proposed furlough notice orally and in writing to a designated deciding official and raise all those affirmative defenses. And the agency's deciding official has to make a decision. You know, is this furlough as applied to this employee somehow a prohibited personnel practice? If so, then we can't do it. We have to go back to the drawing board. So it could be a real administrative nightmare for the agencies if all of these employees get together and try to challenge the furloughs, or certainly if the major federal sector unions do it on a global perspective.
Well, about one in four federal workers outside of the Postal Service is either a union member or is in a union bargaining unit. They're covered by the union. So could that 26%, would they have special advantages over people who are not in a bargaining unit or who don't belong to a union?
Yeah, their unions can get together and basically file a mass grievance if they can identify that the way the agency is going to apply the furlough requirements is somehow having a disparate impact on union members or their unionized workers versus non-unionized workers. And obviously collective bargaining, you know, the unions have more clout in terms of their bargaining power than individual employees. So if the federal unions get together and file massive grievances across the board, it could really lock up the furloughs even beyond mid to late April, you know, until the grievances are resolved, which could take months and months, frankly, to go to arbitration on these things. So, you know, Congress believes this is going to be a quick fix, a way to save $85 billion in the federal, budget. But the reality is it's going to cost them more than they expect in terms of defending these actions in arbitrations or MSPB appeals.
Yeah, well, this is the kind of thing that I think the devil is in the details, and the law of unintended consequences might kick in here. If you had, say, one in four federal workers makes a federal case out of this and decides to fight it, that could stall their furlough action, I guess, for months and months, possibly, and the cost to the government in defending this could be tremendous, huh?
Sure. Each one of these MSPB cases costs the agencies about $10,000 to $15,000 to defend. And the MSPB guidance is that they're supposed to have, you know, hearings and decisions in these cases within 120 days of the date on which the MSPB appeal is filed. So if you take, you know, one particular employee's appeal, it takes 4 months to get a judge decision and a year and a half to get a decision on a petition for review at the full MSPB, and multiply that by, you know, hundreds of thousands of potential appellants, you know, it's going to be a nightmare for the agencies, and it's going to end up costing them probably $85 billion or something close to that to defend these cases. So this may not be the best way to go about saving the $85 billion that Congress wants to save.
Well, if you're a federal worker and you claim this discrimination, and I know that's one of the grounds, if you say the furlough is discrimination against you, how do you prove that? If everybody in the office is furloughed, how could I go into the MSPB or anybody and say I was being discriminated against?
Well, you would have to really get the statistics as to how the furloughs are falling, you know, in terms of EEO protected groups. So if you're challenging it based upon your gender, for example, you would have to get from the agency in discovery the statistical analysis of who's getting furloughed, how long are they getting furloughed for, and what, by the way, are their genders. So if statistically the way the furlough is being rolled out in that particular agency or competitive level, it has a statistically significant disparate impact on, you know, a gender group or a racial group or a disability group, for example, those folks could get together and file a class action, frankly, against the agency and say that, you know, this policy, this furlough policy, which on its face seems neutral in terms of its EEO implications, if we can prove statistically that the way it's actually being applied has a disparate impact on a particular EEO group, then those folks may have a valid disparate impact EEO claim.
John, I want to ask you more about who's in a protected group after a short break here, talking with John Mahoney here on Federal News Radio.
Agency of the Month, Department of Homeland Security, sponsored by Ardent MC, a HubZone contractor.
Dan Gerstein from the DHS Science and Technology Directorate talks about learning from industry partners.
When you talk about cybersecurity, when you talk about biodefense, the government is not the leader in these industries. And so it really does behoove us to work very closely.
Agency of the Month, Thursdays at 10 a.m. in February on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m. I'm Gillian Brockell.
From the tropical island of Maui to the top of Capitol Hill, Ardent MC, a HubZone contractor, solves difficult problems. Since 2003, Ardent MC has delivered the Department of Homeland Security's Common Operational Picture, which allows information to move throughout the agency when supporting state, local, and federal emergency response. Ardent MC utilizes its HubZone certification to promote technology and employment in underutilized areas, like their Maui Software Development Center. Ardent MC is known for taking the chaos out of complexity. Visit ardentmc.com to learn more. Here's Jeff Eisensmith, Chief Information Security Officer, Department of Homeland Security, on the Federal Executive Forum on Cybersecurity, sponsored by Lockheed Martin.
I think a rising star is going to be cyber kill chain. It takes advantage of two really major things here: knowledge management of what has gone down before and anticipating what's coming at us. And it also gives you real-life metrics that we're able to build real business cases of what we need to get the infrastructure where it should be.
Listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group. Log on to federalnewsradio.com.
It happens millions of times every day. Cyber attacks aimed at the networks that are the brains and backbone of every government program and military mission. At Lockheed Martin, we understand the importance of cybersecurity. That's why we build security into every system we develop and integrate. Assuring that our customers can carry out their missions without disruptions is all a question of how. And it is the how that makes all the difference. Lockheed Martin. We never forget who we're working for.
Do you hear that? That's a satellite 500 miles above the Earth. And no, you can't hear it or see it, but it's there. With Raytheon technology that's helping to predict the weather, monitor our climate, or capture images of our planet. A lot of Raytheon solutions are actively at work in much the same way. Unseen, but unmatched. After all, when your mission is space, the possibilities are infinite. Raytheon. Customer success is our mission. Do you hear that? That's a zettabyte. The amount of data the world generates every 6 months. 5 times more data than the combined storage of every hard drive on Earth. In a sea of data this huge, Raytheon Cyber Solutions deliver security, efficiency, and resiliency. After all, when your mission is cyber, every bit matters. Raytheon. Customer success is our mission.
Tune in weekly to the Financial Safari and get that common sense approach to financial and retirement planning.
I mean, I like to have guarantees instead of hoping and praying when we're talking about retirement. The person who has you in the risk account doesn't want you to know about it. If you try to do everything yourself, you don't have a team behind you giving you the advice, but more importantly, telling you what's wrong. Just stop doing bad things in your portfolio. It could take the worry out of living in retirement.
Tune in to the Financial Safari with Coach Pete DeRuda and local trusted advisor Michael Kinnett, Sunday mornings at 8 on 1500 AM.
The Washington Wizards are back.
Spins, fades, banks, scores, and one. Okafor. Up court to Crawford. No look pass. Ariza stuffed to it.
Crawford drives baseline. Whips it in the corner. Sheldon Mack for three.
Single game tickets are on sale now. Call 202-661-5050. That's 202-661-5050. Or buy your tickets online at WashingtonWizards.com/tickets.
Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. I'm talking with John Mahoney. He's a Washington attorney and a specialist in federal employee matters. And today we're looking at the possibility of furloughs, sequestration, and that sort of thing. John, if anybody wanted to get in touch with you, how would they do it?
Well, they can reach me on the web at fedattorney.com. My email address is jmahoney, M-A-H-O-N-E-Y, at fedattorney.com. And my telephone number is 202-787-1900.
Very good. Okay. Now, I wanted to ask you, you were talking about EEO protected groups as people who could maybe make a case that the furloughing them would be an act of discrimination. Who's in this EEO protected group?
Well, for EEO purposes, it covers someone's race, color, sex, national origin, religion, age, disability, or prior EEO activity if someone has filed a complaint before they get retaliation protection. And basically the best place to look for these prohibited personnel practice protected groups is in 5 United States Code Section 2302B. B1 is the EEO bases. B8 is whistleblower protection. If an employee is engaged in protected whistleblowing activity, they gain protection from subsequent personnel actions. And if they believe they're being retaliated against, they can file a whistleblower complaint with the Office of Special Counsel. And if, in fact, they are furloughed for 30 days or more, they can challenge that furlough at the MSPB as being retaliatory for whistleblowing activity.
Well, I remember, goes back many years now, that one of the postal unions urged all of its members to file an EEO complaint. And one of the reasons, I guess, was that once you filed a complaint, that gives you protection.
It certainly is a basis for, you know, trying to protect yourself, and there is such a thing as preemptory EEO or whistleblower complaints. You know, if you look like you're going to be disciplined, sometimes federal employees will file a preemptive strike EEO complaint or a grievance or a whistleblower case to try to gain insurance against the subsequent forthcoming discipline. So that is a technique that federal employees have used in the past. But, you know, the important thing is now, you know, since the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act came into effect at the end of December, you know, federal employees can seek unlimited compensatory damages and attorney's fees for whistleblower claims. So, you know, for EEO cases, you can seek up to $300,000 of compensatory damages. For whistleblower claims, it's unlimited at this point, and it's so new that we don't really have a good guidance as to what unlimited means. So this could end up costing the agencies quite a lot of money in terms of emotional distress and compensatory damages if an employee is successful in challenging a furlough.
Well, given the definition of the protected group, who's not in it?
Well, pretty much everybody is in it. I mean, obviously, we all have a race, a gender, an age, and you know, some of us have a disability status, some of us don't as we get older. So everybody is protected on an EEO basis. You know, employees who have filed grievances or complaints are protected from retaliation. Obviously, too, big in the federal government is veterans' preference. You know, agencies cannot take personnel actions based solely on someone's veterans status or prior service in the military, because the USARA statute and the prohibited personnel practice statute make those types of personnel actions prohibited. So, you know, across the board, you can always find one way or another that an employee is protected from retaliation under a prohibited personnel practice statute.
Yeah, I would think we've gotten a number of questions here at Federal News Radio from people who want to know if veterans' preference would be an issue in the furloughs, and I tell them generally probably not, because if they furlough everybody in your office or everybody in your occupational group, then it would be hard, I would think, to make a case that they got me because I was a veteran.
Yeah, I mean, again, it would take some statistical analysis to see how the furloughs are actually being implemented in that particular agency.
Is it possible that a part of an agency that was, say, predominantly female or predominantly minority, and if they furloughed those people, that looking at the, if you went at it that way statistically, that group could claim that they were being discriminated against, even if it was sort of an across-the-board thing?
Yeah, you know, the case is called the disparate impact case. If you've got a facially neutral personnel policy, like the policy to institute furloughs, if the way the agency rolls out that policy has a disparate impact on a particular protected group, and you can statistically show that over the course of the furlough, then those folks could file an EEO complaint. The employees of the federal government have to file an EEO complaint with their agency's EEO office within 45 calendar days of when they knew or should have known they were discriminated against. So it is important that if an agency employee believes that their rights are being impinged, that they really should seek, you know, competent legal counsel as soon as possible around the March 1st time frame, because the deadline to appeal a furlough is 30 calendar days from the first effective date of the furlough to the MSPB. Union grievance procedures have varying different deadlines, which may be shorter than 30 days, frankly. And for an EEO complaint, they have to file them within 45 calendar days from the first day of the furlough. So they, you know, federal employees can't wait around thinking about whether they're going to take action. They need to do so promptly.
Have you seen anything or heard from anybody or anecdotally that people are joining unions to give them a little added protection?
Well, you know, I haven't seen a real uptick yet because, you know, this is all sort of up in the air still. I mean, we're sort of looking at crunch time now.
Yeah.
That it's the 20th of February, and we only have till March 1st. But it certainly wouldn't necessarily be a bad idea if your position is eligible to be covered by a union. It may be a good idea to join up now, as they say, because, you know, this thing's coming down the road pretty soon.
I don't know how far down the weeds you've got with this, but we've had numerous questions, and we were talking with benefits strategist John Elliott not long ago, and he said that the furlough itself would not have any impact on the employee's high three. You know, we're talking about a maximum defenses plan is for a maximum of 22 furlough days, and John said that would not have any impact on the high three. What about things like leave, vacation, and sick leave? Do you know if that will have any impact?
Well, it shouldn't. I mean, you know, the furlough is supposed to be taken during normal working days. So, you know, there are ways to sort of maneuver it around. You know, if we do it across a federal holiday, do we only then lose two days of pay as opposed to three if there's a federal holiday in the middle? So there's all types of different, you know, scenarios that could be rolled out by the agencies. The agencies have discretion to decide how and when to implement the furloughs. You know, OPM is recommending that rather than talk about furloughs in terms of the number of days of the furlough, the agency should be considering talking about it in terms of the number of hours. How many hours should an employee be furloughed? So if the person's on a compressed work schedule or an alternative work schedule, it's not necessarily one solid day a week. It may be, you know, 5 hours here, 3 hours there, over the course of whatever the pay period or the course of the fiscal year, so as to, you know, have a more even impact on employees who are on alternative work schedules.
This looks like a paperwork, an administrative, and a legal nightmare in the making. What about if I'm a federal manager and I'm the middle person, but I've gotten orders from on high to do this, and then I must hand out the notices to people. What should managers be doing now other than maybe working out a lot?
Exactly. Well, federal managers need to know who to refer their workforce employees to get answers to the questions that they need about how the furlough is going to impact them. And agencies, frankly, need to develop a communication network so that employees and also the unions who represent them know who the point person is to, you know, file complaints or to, you know, try to argue for a different way to apply the furlough. So it's certainly going to be a huge administrative nightmare for the federal agencies and their managers.
And again, you're saying that with the 30-day notice, which can't go out in at the earliest March 1, assuming sequestration is allowed to happen. So we're talking about furloughs, if any, that would begin in April.
Exactly. So between March 1 and April 1, you know, it's going to be chaos, frankly. You know, the agencies are working behind the scenes right now to come up with their contingency plans if sequestration comes into play on March 1st. You know, how are we going to roll out these RIFs? Who's going to get RIFs? You know, who's going to get furloughed? Who, you know, what competitive areas are we going to be applying this to? How many days or hours per week, you know, per employee are we talking about to meet our budget reduction, depending on what an individual agency's reduction level is in terms of their budget dollars? So it's not going to apply evenly across the whole federal government. Each agency has their own budget target, and they have to work up the formula as to how many hours or days of furlough per, you know, employee by the numbers of employees we have on the rolls will it take for us to reach our target goal. So it's going to be applied individually within, you know, each agency differently. So it's going to be a nightmare in terms of, you know, I've heard my friend in the other agencies not getting furloughed this much. How come I am? So there's going to be all kinds of arguments and cross arguments that are going to be flying back and forth between the employees and the agency over the course of the month of March.
The old carpool will never be the same.
It never will.
Yeah, well, you know, the defense is talking about 800,000 people possibly affected. They're having a press conference within an hour or so to spell out in detail, but they were talking about 22 days, maximum of 22 days. And if this is a fiscal year thing and it starts in April, then it's going to be more than one day a week.
Yep. Yeah, because the target across the federal government is $85 billion. So, you know, each agency's reduction in terms of their budget dollars is going to be different. So they've got to figure out within that budget, you know, framework, how many, you know, employees have to be furloughed for how many days or how many hours. So it's, you know, right now I'm sure they're working pretty diligently to try to figure all this out. And when it rolls out in March, the unions can bargain over the impact and implementation of the furlough, which may delay it further. And then obviously the notices have to go out 30 days before the furlough start, and the employees can raise all types of EO or other affirmative defenses to try to stall or, you know, get over the whole furlough idea in the first place. So it's going to, you know, and then MSPB appeals and union grievances and arbitrations and board petitions for review and federal circuit, you know, appeals of the PFRs at the MSPB. You know, it's going to cause more administrative nightmares than it's going to solve, I think.
Wow, sounds like fun. All right, John Mahoney, thank you very much for being with us. We'll get you back on this maybe in April, see how it's going.
You're welcome.
Stay tuned. We're going to be talking with the Federal Timesman about a variety of things here on Federal News Radio.
What are the top priorities for the FBI's Facilities and Logistics Services Division? How is the FBI pursuing more sustainable business and supply chain practices? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and more with Patrick Findlay, Assistant Director, FBI's Facilities and Logistics Services Division, next week on the Business of Government Hour.
For those of you who like to check your connection speed, you can go to broadbandreports.com. You can get their speed test. You can test your upload and download speed. I like to do that periodically. Sometimes my Fios download speed gets up to 16 megabits per second, but this morning I had 10 down and 3 up. And you've got 60 megabits per second. I'd love to have that kind of bandwidth, but 60 could be overkill. But I'd say anything more than 30 is probably not worth the money.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
Concerned about your health? Then be sure to catch the groundbreaking radio show, Essentials of Healthy Living, brought to you by Village Green Apothecary in Bethesda. Join hosts Dana Lake and Kevin Passero as they bring you the latest news about traditional and alternative medicine, dietary supplements, nutrition, and healthy living. Tune in every Sunday at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Visit myvillagegreen.com, listen to past shows, and discover other healthy living resources.
Essentials of Healthy Living is sponsored by Enzymatic Therapy and Nordic Naturals.
Please join the American Federation of Government Employees for its series, Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. The weekly program gives you the real story on what's happening inside federal agencies and the rights of federal employees. Hear the latest from the nation's top lawmakers, celebrities, journalists, union leaders, and federal workers. Don't miss AFGE's Inside Government, Friday at 10 a.m., right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m. Here's Joe Klimovich, CIO NOAA, on the Path to FDCCI Compliance panel, sponsored by Thundercat Technology and NetApp.
And our strategy is probably consistent with other departments, is to virtualize operating systems and applications to the maximum extent, move as many applications and services to the cloud as possible. We're doing a lot of this through centralized, very strong centralized governance.
To listen to the whole program, log on to federalnewsradio.com, keyword FDCCI.
Is your agency on track for data center consolidation compliance? Data center experts at Thundercat Technology can help you consolidate, relocate, and maximize your data center assets. By leveraging NetApp Agile storage solutions and proprietary consolidation tools, Thundercat helps agencies achieve compliance and cut costs by up to 50%. To get help with your data center migration strategy, go to FDCCIConnect.com to download the FDCCI strategy guide today. FDCCIConnect.com.
Are budget cuts affecting your mission performance? Is your organization actively seeking innovative approaches to elevate performance? Just doing more with less is not a recipe for success. Learn how WBB can rapidly help agency decision makers move past managing the current budget crisis, prioritize needs, and allocate your agency's resources efficiently. At WBB, quality comes standard. Visit their website to download their free white paper and sign up for their free webinar at WBBINC.com. That's WBBINC.com.
Future chemotherapy treatments might have fewer side effects by taming cancer cells instead of killing them. Cancer cells thrive and rapidly multiply in their microenvironment, the biochemical mix in which tumors bathe. But Jennifer West, a Duke bioengineer, says in lab experiments,
if we provided them with materials that would mimic a normal microenvironment, we saw that the cells really behaved like normal cells. This gives us some new targets for potential therapeutics.
West says instead of a chemotherapy that kills cancer but other cells too, causing many side effects, it might tame a tumor cell to become,
if not a completely normal cell, at least a very much less aggressive cell.
And prolong patients' lives. To find out more, please go to www.nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hey, Mike Causey, welcome back to Your Turn. Glad you stuck with us, and I hope you found that interesting, a little scary talk about sequestration there from John Mahoney. My guests now are Sean Riley and Steve Losey. They are senior writers for the Federal Times. And, guys, I don't know when we've had as much to talk about as the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, it sure does seem like the ball is just rolling. The avalanche has started now.
You know, we're looking at it. We've got a pay freeze. We've got the unfunded liability of the civil service and the FERS retirement system that's coming up, become an issue again. Crackdown on poor performers, as you had in the paper yesterday. We've got sequestration, of course, and the Postal Service plan to get out of the federal employee health benefits thing. Sean, why don't we start off with sequestration? Where are we?
Well, we're in the countdown. I mean, it's, sequestration, if nothing happens, nothing changes, and it doesn't appear that anything is likely to happen, will go into effect March 1st. You know, the sky will not fall. The cutbacks won't be felt immediately, but it will begin at that point. Congress, as you know, is out this week, so nothing's going to happen before Monday. And when Congress does return, there'll only be 4 days to head it off. So what you're seeing now is agencies that have generally been completely silent, apparently on orders from the White House, are now increasingly offering more detailed scenarios of what's going to happen. The Defense Department today notified Congress of potential furloughs that could come in April. These would go probably 1 day per week through the rest of the fiscal year. Other agencies in letters to the Senate Appropriations Committee are outlining their plans, in some cases furloughs, in other cases cutting back, laying off temporary employees, retired annuitants, that kind of thing.
Shows how this thing works in Washington. The agencies were told to soft pedal it by the White House, particularly before the election, but even afterward they were told to minimize it, and now all of a sudden they've been given the orders to squeal loudly.
That's exactly right, and the Army, I think, yesterday put out a very nice report detailing the state-by-state impacts, in case members of Congress aren't aware of them already, that sequestration will bring, and I think you're going to see a lot more of that in the next week or so. And I think, you know, the goal is clearly to ratchet up the pressure on Congress, to ratchet up public pressure on members of Congress to do something to head this off.
Okay. Hey, Steve Losey, on the pay freeze, now I take it the House has approved a continuation of the pay freeze through 2013. What's going to happen in the Senate?
My bet, probably nothing. The Senate is controlled by Democrats who are very reluctant to further extend the pay freeze in and of itself on federal employees. You've got people who are very friendly towards federal employees there. And so what I think is going to happen is this bill itself, H.R. 273, is not going to go anywhere. However, I think the principle of a pay freeze could probably be rolled into a broader bill, perhaps something averting or delaying sequestration. But I do not see the Democrats who control the Senate moving forward with just giving up that bargaining chit of a pay freeze in exchange for nothing. If right. they're going to agree to a pay freeze, it's going to be in exchange for some increased tax revenue from the wealthy or defense cuts or something that delays or averts cuts to domestic spending elsewhere. So the pay freeze itself is not going anywhere. The pay freeze bill is not going anywhere, but maybe it'll come back down the line.
You always have politics and strategy mixed in these things. When President Obama proposed a two-year federal pay freeze, the Democrats in the Senate went along with it rather, and yet now the proposal to extend it from March through December is suddenly a bargaining chip again.
That's right. You know, President Obama wants federal employees to get a 0.5% pay raise at the end of March, however, he opposed he said last week that he opposes the pay freeze bill. But one thing I thought was interesting was he stopped short of recommending a veto of it, which makes me suspect they may be kind of leaving themselves a little bit of wiggle room to acquiesce to a pay freeze extension.
Right, and that would give federal workers who have been saying so far that they're funding this fight entirely to trim the deficit, this would give them more ammunition for what it's worth, wouldn't it?
That's right. Federal employees have already contributed about $103 billion to deficit reduction through the pay freeze, through increased retirement contributions federal employees being hired this year. If the pay freeze is extended, that would add another $11 billion on top of the savings that they've already contributed. So federal employees have given an awful lot to this deficit reduction effort, and unions and other groups that represent federal employees say, hey, we're the only ones who have been asked to give it the office. It's time for other people to step up.
Sean, the Postal Service unveiled plans some time ago, although not in any detail. They said they wanted to go it alone, get out of the federal employee health benefits program, and set up their own health plan. What's the deal with that?
Well, it was interesting, Mike. There was a hearing last week before the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee on the Postal Service's financial crisis. And as you might expect, the focus of lawmakers was on the Postal Service's recently announced decision to end Saturday mail delivery starting in August without necessarily getting congressional approval. But the Postmaster General testified at some length, and it was interesting that he really underscored that the Postal Service still wants to get out of the FEHBP and set up its own plan. I mean, he claims this would save it a lot of money and that it could provide comparable or better benefits to employees and retirees. But the Postal Service, I mean, this goes back now about a year and a half when they first announced their intent to do this, got a very cool reception from the Office of Personnel Management, which, as far as I know, has not changed its position that postal employees are well served by the current system. But the Postal Service has yet to really release any detail on exactly what it would do. But the Postal Service Inspector General last year did a pretty lengthy report looking at least what the Postal Service had in mind at that time. And a big part of it would involve requiring employees or retirees 65 or older to go on to Medicare. That would become essentially their primary health insurer, and then whatever Postal Service plan is created in lieu of the FEHBP would be the backup. And the Postal Service says, you know, this would essentially eliminate the requirement that it pre-fund retiree health benefits, since there wouldn't really be all retirees essentially would be on Medicare, and there'd be much less of a need for any kind of pre-funding of retiree health benefits in the future, because it would be covered through Medicare. But they'd also be looking at according to this IG report, that they would charge employees a standard deductible before the Postal Service would cover any costs not covered by Medicare. They're looking at some efficiencies. They were at some point looking at freezing contribution, for retiree health care, but they've dropped that part of it, at least according to the Inspector General report. But it was interesting, the IG said that the Postal Service really needs to spell out exactly what this would mean for everyone involved, and thus far, as far as I know, the Postal Service has not done that.
I don't know of anybody outside of the top postal management who's come up with a way that they would save money and have a better plan for employees.
Well, they just haven't said, and I mean, the Postmaster General a couple weeks ago, noted that the average age of the postal workforce is almost 54. And typically, of course, people tend to have more claims, to be more costly to cover the older they get. So this is one of numerous unanswered questions related to what the Postal Service wants to do. As I said, was interesting was the extent to which the Postmaster General, Pat Donahue, stressed that they still want to do this. And it's just not clear how they're going to proceed. The head of HR over the Postal Service, Tony Viglianti, is retiring, and so it's also not clear what effect that's going to have, because presumably he was closely involved in any discussions about going ahead with this.
Good. I'm going to ask you something about age in the Postal Service when we come back here after a short break on Federal News Radio.
The leader in informational seminars on federal benefits, financial, and retirement planning. NITP was established in 1984 and is 100% devoted to federal planning seminars. The mission is to educate federal employees and enable them to make fully informed decisions regarding their financial futures and retirement options. Through a variety of teaching platforms and seminars, NITP has the experience to help with your planning needs. Visit NITPinc.com. That's NITPinc.com for more information.
Mythics Consulting is hiring. Mythics Consulting is an award-winning Oracle Platinum specialized consulting partner working to enable the Oracle-powered enterprise. And Mythics Consulting is looking for IT professionals that get the job done. Available positions include leading Oracle solution areas like applications, enterprise content management, and big data. Mythics Consulting is the go-to Oracle systems integrator with open positions and ready to hire high-skilled IT professionals. Check it out at mythics.com/careers. That's mythics.com/careers.
What you don't know about federal pay, benefits, and retirement can cost you. Get the answers you need with a free publication from NARF, the experts on federal retirement and benefits. Download FAQs about your federal benefits today at fedfaqs.org. NARF, the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association, unravels the most complex rules and requirements feds encounter. Download your free guide today at fedfaqs.org. That's FEDFAQS.org.
Mom, I had the best dream.
Well, good morning to you, too.
Okay, so I was a knight. I had a sword, and our house was a castle. It was this angry dragon.
It was kind of scary.
Oh, yeah?
But I protected the castle.
Oh, that's my brave little man. I'm glad our castle is safe.
Your home is your castle, and sometimes you need help defending it. The National Association of Realtors supports maintaining homeowner tax incentives because they make home ownership more affordable for more families. Learn more at houselogic.com.
Paid for by the National Association of Realtors.
The Guiding You Home Safely Report, provided and paid for by the National Air Traffic Controllers Association.
The federal debt limit extension deal passed by Congress assures the federal government will not default on its loans through mid-May. But military budget experts say the extension deal could also increase the chances of sequestration. In the continuing budget fight, both parties are so well entrenched in their opposition of other alternatives, such as tax increases or entitlement cuts, it's possible that sequestration may be the least common denominator between the two parties. Sequestration could have a negative impact on jobs, the nation's economy, and essential government services.
Hi, I'm Paul Rinaldi, President of National Air Traffic Controllers Association. Safety is our top priority, and last year was proof. It was the safest year in aviation history. We represent dedicated professionals who work 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, guiding 70,000 flights a day safely to their destination. Next time you fly, remember, we guide you home safely. Visit us at natca.org.
Eagle Hoops fans, the best seats in Bender Arena for the 2012-2013 season are just a phone call away. Call the AU Athletics Ticket Office at 202-885-TIXX today to place your $50 deposit on 2012-2013 season tickets to see AU Eagles men's basketball. Season tickets are the only way to secure the best sideline reserve chair back seats all season long. Place your season ticket deposit at 202-885-TIXX today and buy American.
Please join Jim Fleisig Tuesday, February 26th at 12 noon for his monthly series, The Federal Executive Forum, Mobility in Government, Progress and Best Practices. The panel includes government leaders from the National Nuclear Security Administration, the Environmental Protection Agency, and DISA. Don't miss the Federal Executive Forum, Tuesday, February 26th at 12 noon on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com.
Sponsored by Citrix, Palo Alto Networks, Appian, and Immix Group.
We are now more than 1 year into the Shared First strategy. Many first-year initiatives focused on simple feats like email, but virtually no area of IT is exempt, from data centers to mobile devices. With agencies due to deliver their enterprise roadmap for shared services to OMB, join AFSEA Bethesda on February 28th at the Bethesda North Marriott to hear top agency officials discuss the shift to more strategic sourcing and a greater focus on commodity IT. Register today at afseabethesda.org/febbreakfast.
Headed to Fort Detrick or the I-270 Technology Corridor, Federal News Radio can be heard crystal clear on 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. It's the same great station, just on an added frequency. Get the latest news about the federal government and government contractors. Hear exclusive interviews with the movers and shakers in the federal arena. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM or 820 AM in Frederick, Maryland. Federal News Radio, your source for federal news now.
Postal Service and its plan to have a go-it-alone health plan. You said the average age of the Postal Service was 54.
That's what the Postmaster General, yeah. Pat Donahue, said, yeah.
Yeah, and I seem to remember just a few years back that the average age of the federal workforce, including the Postal Service but also other federal agencies, was something like 47 or 48 with 12 years service. Now, that the workforce may have aged, but that would put the Postal Service as not only older than the regular federal service, but it's an industrial-type organization. It takes a strain on people, I'm thinking, health-wise.
Yeah, and absolutely. I mean, if you've ever been inside a processing plant,
yeah,
it's kind of like a factory. And you have to note, I mean, the Postal Service workforce, and I think you need to get, they have to get deserve credit for this. They have shrunk that workforce by several hundred thousand career employees over the last decade or so. You know, without resorting to layoffs, through attrition, early out programs, that kind of thing. But the corollary is, I think they've done very little, relatively little new hiring. And so when you've got fewer people coming in the door, of course, the average or median age of your workforce is going to go up.
Right. And it's not a high income, a high wage agency, so people might tend to work a little bit longer than they would in some other parts of the federal government.
I hadn't thought about that. That's an excellent point. I mean, the average age, I think, of a career employee, whether a clerk or a letter carrier, is around $50,000, which isn't, terrible, but it's certainly not something that's going to let you, stop working at 35.
Yeah, okay. Steve, you had a couple good stories this week. One that intrigued me was about the bosses cracking down on poor performers.
Yeah, one thing that I've been noticing is that there's been some indications that managers are getting tougher. The Merit Systems Protection Board came out with a report a couple of weeks back that showed that the number of cases in which they're deciding appeals of performance actions and denial of within grade step increases and adverse actions has ticked up over the last year, in the case of performance actions and step increase denials, considerably so, 41%, 27%. And that made me think, what's going on here? So I went back to the Office of Personnel Management and asked them for some stats on how many step increases have been denied in the last couple of years. And it's still not very many. It's still less than a tenth of a percentage point. But there has been a noticeable increase in the number of step increase denials that have been handed out in the federal workforce. So what this suggests is managers are feeling the pinch. We all know this. We've been reporting on this for, the better part of 2 years now, that budgets are going down. And if your budget is going down and you've got if you got people retiring, your staff's getting cut, you don't have the breathing room to carry people who aren't really pulling their weight. So if someone is slacking off at work, you might kind of crack down on them a little bit more and say, hey, we need you to up your game and get this job done. And the numbers suggest that that is what's happening.
Because these step increases are no small thing. They're about 3%, and they come for longevity and, of course, satisfactory service. But I know even as far back as the Carter administration, the president and others called them being there raises, and that is if you just show up and stay on the job long enough, you automatically get it. Federal workers and unions resent the fact that they're automatic, but in fact they're almost automatic.
Essentially, yes. Unions say, no, they're not automatic, but they, in all but name, they are. The number of step increase denials increased from 737 in 2009 to almost 1,000 in 2012. That is about 0.07% of the general schedule workforce. When you look at the number of people who are actually eligible for step increase in any given year, it ticks up to about 0.1%. So a 0.1% is virtually nothing. So yes, you do. They are virtually automatic, and they are the one thing that has been a pretty regular pay increase for federal employees during these last 2 years, when pay raises have at least supposedly been frozen.
Yeah, you could have had, in that two-year period, you could have had a third or more who got a 3% raise despite the pay freeze.
Yeah, by my calculations, about 53% of the GS workforce is up for a step increase in any given year.
Okay, very good. Yeah, that's a big deal. So you could get a pay raise and a step increase at the same time.
Yeah, in under normal circumstances, yes. In most years, you might get your step increase, which was, you know, more or less 3%, and you might also get a bump to your pay scales. Now, that pay scale bump is what has been frozen the last 2 years, so you're only getting one pay raise.
Yeah, interesting story here about the federal pension system, the unfunded liability, and I remember my oldest son's birthday is Friday, and I remember when he was born on a Friday, and I raced down to the office of the Washington Post in those days and passed out cigars, It's a Boy cigars. Of course, now that would be politically incorrect and probably a firing offense, but I remember one of the older guys, ancient, he must have been about 50, but he said, he rejected the cigar. He said, save your money. He said, that kid is going to cost you, and he came up with some figure, $200,000 or something like that, and I think I was making $76 a week at the time. But that was my unfunded liability, and I thought maybe I should leave him at Sibley Hospital. But as it worked out, it's okay. And I know you, some of you guys are new fathers too. But isn't that what an unfunded liability is? It's a future obligation.
Yeah, exactly. You know, when they calculate the unfunded liability, they say, okay, if you know, for all these people who are federal employees right now, by the time they retire and, you know, decades from now when they pass away, this is how much money we're going to have to pay out. And the unfunded liability is how much we don't have accounted for. Now, the vast majority of the unfunded liability is from the civil service retirement system, they started to do away with 25 years ago. And there was a major flaw when that system was designed. It did not require that the government make sure that it keeps it keeps covering the cost of CSRS. So they created FERS. FERS does require that the government keep up its payments. But the unfunded liability grew almost $140 billion in fiscal 2011. It is now $761 billion. More than three-quarters of $1 trillion, which is kind of alarming. And some Republicans, such as Tom Coburn, Senator Coburn, who is a noted deficit hawk, have been saying this is a reason why the government should get rid of the defined benefit pension for federal employees. Now, many say that, no, you shouldn't get rid of it. But President Obama also has said that he is concerned about the unfunded liability. If you remember, about 2 years ago, he released his deficit reduction plan, and it calls for increasing the amount all federal employees, contribute to their pensions by 1.2 percentage points, and using that extra money to pay down the unfunded liability. Now, the FERS system, when I last wrote this story, the FERS system was in the black. It had about a $12 billion surplus at the end of fiscal 2010. But its fiscal outlook has worsened considerably. It's now $20 billion in the red. And that
was never supposed to happen. Oops. Lauren is giving us the exit sign here. So thank you very much for being with us. We'll talk to you guys next week. Remember, our shows are archived on our homepage. So you can see them anytime, read them anytime. And we'll talk to you. See you next weekend.
Thank you.